Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Well, end-of-life decisions are challenging, and they're fraught with many difficult decisions, especially when you're no longer able to make your wishes known to your caregivers or your healthcare team. So what can you do to help now before you can't participate in those decisions? Well, here with us this morning with some answers is Mark Budalieri. He's the Director of Social Work at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Mark. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly, when we talk about kind of healthcare directives or decisions that need to be made, what are we talking about? There's a range of things.
Yep. Advanced care planning has multiple forms that can be completed. One is the healthcare proxy for anybody over the age of 18. Second is a living will. Third is a DNR, do not resuscitate order. Fourth is a MOLST, medical order for life-sustaining treatment. And then I would suggest people fill out a durable power of attorney.
Okay, I'm going to take each of those and try to talk about it. But before we talk about the specifics of each of those forms, they obviously have a concept behind them. And the concept is basically tell your wishes before you can no longer express them.
Correct. Completing a healthcare proxy enables somebody with capacity over the age of 18 to write down their wishes and appoint a proxy, an agent, to make decisions on their behalf in the event the person loses capacity.
So basically that person becomes your ombudsman or the person who can help make the decisions. In order for them to do that, then, they really must know your wishes.
Correct. You would pick somebody that could follow your wishes, that you're close with, that would understand how you live your life, what gives meaning to your life, and be able to articulate and stand up for what you want.
So the point here, though, I think is, and I think this is sometimes people feel frightened by this concept, excuse me, or feel it's a morbid thing, but it seems like it's crucial to have these kinds of conversations with someone you trust, who you might then appoint as your proxy, way before you're in that position.
Yeah, the best time to do it is really when you're healthy, and there is a fear about completing an advanced directive that you might die or you're thinking about death as you're completing it. No different than someone getting a new job and filling out health insurance. They're not likely to get sick just because they selected health insurance. Same thing here. Once you complete your healthcare proxy, you put it away, and then in the event you lose capacity, you take it out and it's there, so you don't have to think about it when you're sick.
Mm. It seems to me, though, I would think in your capacity as a social worker, you see all kinds of permutations of people having done it, not having done it, and all the ramifications. Why do you find it so, so important to have had that conversation?
It helps to be able to articulate what you want as opposed to allowing your family to try to figure that out. There's so much stress around having somebody in the hospital that families really are there to help their loved one, and to also have to make decisions without knowing what their loved one wanted is very difficult and very stressful. So it puts a lot of burden on families.
So it's a great gift in a way to give to those who would be your caregivers or the people who love you to have had that conversation and let them know really what you want.
It really is. It's a gift that allows the entire family to kind of get closer in all aspects of life. So if they're having to make decisions on somebody's behalf for end of life, then they already know because they've had that tough conversation.
If you decided to have that conversation somewhat earlier in your life when you're very robust and healthy, is there a need to update this kind of material? I want to go through each of these forms that you were describing or each of these directives, but is there a need? I mean, would you recommend people keep in mind that as you age, maybe some of your concepts or wishes may have changed?
Absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
Absolutely. People should update. Some folks, maybe every year, they talk about it around Thanksgiving. They pick a time of year when the family is together, and they have that conversation. If no changes, they don't have to do anything. If there are changes, they complete a brand new form, and that form then supersedes the previous iteration.
It really does take the pressure off, though, not only the caregivers, the familial caregivers, or your so-called loved ones, but it also does help in the hospital, the healthcare workers as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it helps the physicians and hospital staff to know who to go to when there's an advance directive, and then that person is able to make those decisions legally because you have that form.
So let's take a look at what those parts of the puzzle are. Because I think a lot of people also get overwhelmed by that whole notion, oh, there's all these forms. What do they mean? So let's just start. Why don't you start with the first thing? You have clarified the healthcare proxy, which is basically saying, this person I'm designating as my voice when I can no longer express my wishes.
Correct.
Okay.
The second one would be a living will. And the living
Tell us about that.
The living will is a document whereby an individual could write down their wishes, what they would want and what they would not want. So in the event they received a poor prognosis, they would or would not want life-sustaining efforts. The problem with the living will in New York State is that it's often not triggered. So if you're talking about end of life and don't want this and don't want that, the oncologist might want to know if you want this chemotherapy or not. So if the person lacks capacity and the oncologist goes to your family and asks, would she want this chemotherapy, the living will is not triggered because the oncologist is not saying the person's dying. They just want to offer that treatment.
So in other words, that's an important point I don't think most people know. The only time the living will is triggered is when basically you're on death's door?
Based on what's written on there. So if it is an end-of-life living will and it talks about death's door, then that's when it'll be triggered. So it's so specific versus the healthcare agent on the healthcare proxy. That person can speak for how, on the person's behalf, of what gives their life meaning. So based on the outcome, the risk, the benefits of having that oncological treatment, yes, my loved one would want that, or no, they wouldn't want that.
I'm a little unclear of one thing. Does that mean that the living will is actually can confuse the issue? I mean, would you recommend people do a living will? Is that an important piece of this puzzle?
The healthcare proxy is really the gold standard. I use the living will with people that have no one. So sometimes an individual has no family. They're either estranged or the family is deceased, and they have no one that they could appoint as a healthcare proxy. I think the living will is better than nothing.
Okay, but you're saying it's not as effective, and it can actually almost look like be conflicted?
It can be conflictual. It's also been overturned in the courts because it's not been triggered. So that's where the healthcare proxy really is the...
So what I'm hearing you say is that the person that you designate is really the crucially most important piece of this whole thing, is finding someone that you trust, that you can, to whom you can express your wishes and your desires and have that person take over.
That's correct.
But as you said, there are many circumstances where somebody may not have that option.
That's correct. So the living will...
And give us an example of what you would say in the living will. Help me understand that.
For the living will, I might say that if I can't breathe on my own, I don't want to be put on a ventilator for the rest of my life. If I'm going to be in a persistent vegetative state, I don't want to be plugged into machines and have machines help me survive. If I can't eat or swallow by myself, I don't want long-term feeding if I can't do it on my own. So those are all examples of something that would be written in a living will. But if the conversation that the doctor is having with the family has nothing to do with what I just said, then the living will is never triggered.
I see. A little complicated.
Yeah.
But I think I understand. So what else is needed besides those two things?
For patients that are likely to die within a year, have a very poor prognosis, or are going to live in a nursing home for the rest of their life, they might want to consider a do not resuscitate order, or
that's separate from a living will.
That's separate from a living will. Or an outpatient form called MOLST, M-O-L-S-T, Medical Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. The DNR is something that the physician fills out. It's an actionable medical order. So unlike the healthcare proxy, I complete the healthcare proxy with no notary, no physician. I complete it. I put it in a drawer. In the event I lose capacity, my agent knows where it is. They have a copy, and they can exercise my rights. With the DNR, as soon as the doctor signs it, it's a doctor's order. So it's an actionable order. So do not resuscitate means that if your heart stops, that they're not going to try to restart your heart.
It
has to come from the patient and the doctor. It's a conversation between those two.
And you're saying that if somebody were to determine that they had only a year to live, they would at that point discuss with their doctor whether they wanted a resuscitation or not.
That's correct. And the doctor would probably initiate that conversation.
Okay. So then what else?
I also recommend...
You talked about the MOLST. How is that different from the DNR?
So the MOLST is a hot pink form, literally, developed by Dr. Bamba outside of in Rochester, New York.
So is this a local form?
It's actually now a New York State form.
But it's New York State.
It's New York State.
Okay.
And the MOLST is a transferable DNR. So if the person is home, that hot pink form can be on the refrigerator. And when the EMS, the emergency medical system, comes in, they can not resuscitate or not intubate that individual in the home if it's stipulated on the MOLST.
So once again, the MOLST is really another form of the DNR, just one that travels with the patient. It's portable?
Correct. And we use it as an outpatient form.
Okay. I get that. And then you were talking also about the idea of the...
Durable power of attorney.
So why is that important?
Oftentimes when someone comes to the hospital, the family is trying to figure out how to pay bills for this person, how to make their car payment, how to keep their loved one's life going while they're hospitalized. And without a power of attorney, the financial and legal transactions cannot take place.
So that's very important just in terms of, that's just not assuming that death is near. That's just assuming if you're very incapacitated, you have someone else who can do your business for you.
That's correct.
Okay. And so that's another thing you think is quite important.
Yes. And here at Upstate, we have agreements with three pro bono lawyers. So we have the Fifth Judicial Pro Bono Legal District. We have CLASP, Cancer Legal Advocacy Program. And we have the SU Law Clinic. So these lawyers will come here and meet with patients or families for free and help them complete some of these documents.
So the documents are beyond just the statement of wishes. The documents give you some legal powers, what you're saying.
The durable power of attorney gives you legal powers. So, and you can stipulate on that power of attorney form what those powers are. So access to bank accounts, being able to write a check, being able to... sell assets.
But some of the earlier ones that you mentioned, like the healthcare proxy or the living will, those don't require a lawyer.
Correct.
You could do those right now in the privacy of your own home, get the forms perhaps from your doctor's office or something of that
nature. That's correct. There are certain parts of the healthcare proxy form that have to be filled out to make it valid. So you have to, I mark naming my agent, and then I can select an alternate agent if my agent's not able to participate. I have to sign and date it, and then I have to have two witnesses that aren't myself or my agent or agents that I appointed.
So the point is that if you're incapacitated and you've not filled out a healthcare proxy form, someone in your family, let's say a loved one or a spouse or someone, can function in that role, but not legally? Is that the idea?
So if you are incapacitated and have not completed a form, you cannot complete a form right now. There's a law called the Family Healthcare Decisions Act, and there's an order on who the hospital goes to make decisions.
Really?
In the event you have not completed a healthcare proxy.
So it might not be the person you'd want.
Correct.
So?
It could be an estranged spouse that you haven't seen for 30 years, but
wow,
you're still married.
Wow. So I think that just underscores, in the very little bit of time we have left, the importance of trying to get all your papers in order long before you're in that position.
Absolutely. And the social work department here at Upstate is happy to help.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Mark Budleri. He is the director of social work for Upstate Medical University. I want you to stay with us. We'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air right after this short break.